Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. And I'm speaking to you from Book Tourville. I've started my annual pilgrimage to Barnes & Noble's all over the western states and military bases and all sorts of great places, meeting great people and new readers and old friends and fans and all sorts of stuff. And I enjoy it, although it's kind of grueling. And my travels are on the website, www.threadswestseries.com. So just go to the book signing tab at the top. It'll tell you where I'm at. And no, it does not look like, with shipping and everything else, Christmas season, that I will have book four with me for those of you who I know are inquiring. But she's on the way. Okay. I have a little story to tell you tonight. Actually, this morning. It is 1:30 on Saturday. 1:30 in the morning. But we have a boatload of news, right? We have a boatload of topics to cover this week. I mean, it's been nutso. Of course, we did hire Donald Trump to stir things up, and my, he has a big spoon, and he knows how to whip that pot. Anyway, well, here's what we're going to be covering this morning. We're going to be covering a little bit. I'm going to tell you about what this new tax bill is. I told you that I was going to hold off giving you any opinion other than pointing out the absolute complete, I mean, how these Democrats, these alt-left folks like Schumer, etc., how they look in the camera and lie through their teeth, knowing that they're lying. I mean, this is not like they're making a mistake. This is like Barack Obama looking in the camera saying, you can keep your doctor, you can keep your hospital, your rates will go down 2,500, blah, blah, blah. It's just unbelievable. It really is. And there's a moral deficit on the left. There's no doubt about it. They will do anything. They will throw anybody under the bus. They will sacrifice the United States, American values, and the security and financial security, safety and security, physical and money, of you and your family to achieve their ideological ends and to keep their money in power. It's truly, truly treasonous. And as we know from the sagacious sex fuzz of the last month, it is not only scandalous, it is lecherous, shall we say. Lecherous. How's that? The lecherous loony left. We're going to be talking about, so I'm going to bring that into focus for you. And I'm actually going to give you some examples. Hopefully they got it posted. I can't promise. There should be an article under tax, which was an excellent summary by the Heritage Foundation with charts and some great links in it. And you can really get a feel for how this tax bill, at least as it's sitting right now, the House and Senate bills, how it will affect you and your family. And I think it is the most cogent summary of things. I'm going to review it with you briefly tonight, and hopefully that article is up there. And click on those links. They have charts and all sorts of stuff and typical family situations, which I'm going to review, but pretty helpful to see it too. We are going to talk about the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Board. Outrageous. I mean, that's a huge story, and it was buried by all the rest of the stories this week. But it has tremendous significance, and I want to point it out to you. I'm sure you've heard the news. Maybe you haven't. The mainstream media kind of covered it, but they covered it kind of making the outgoing director of this Obama Elizabeth Warren concoction, illegal and unconstitutional concoction, kind of making him a hero. But I'll explain all that to you. And then just a little bit on Black Lives Matter and their outrage over a white Christmas. Wow, unbelievable. And then it was brought to my attention, and you are correct, and I'm glad that I missed it last week. I was going to tell you what Corrick, the loony left federal judge out there in San Francisco, has to do with Roy Moore, the guy running for Senate down there in Alabama, because they are inextricably linked. And your eyebrows will go up as I explain that to you. Even more so, I might add, with the outrageous verdict on Kate Steinle and her illegal alien, seven-time felon, five-time deported, scumbag killer. It all ties in, folks. It all ties in. And it's a much bigger picture than just any little snippet of it. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the docs that the FBI finally coughed up on the Loretta Lynch-Bill Clinton meeting on the tarmac a few days before Comey exonerated Hillary publicly using a memo that he had started drafting 4 months earlier, before he had even done his interviews and investigation. I've been over that, so we're not going to rehash old stuff. But I will go over these new documents with you because they're exactly what I told you they would be. Then we're going to talk a little bit about, this whole Flynn thing, which the mainstream media is just breathless. Oh, we finally have Trump in our sights. And I mean, you know, please, please. They are rabid dogs. In the meantime, the mainstream media is getting decimated by firings because of, all these goody-two-shoes who have pointed with glee at any scandal having to do with Republicans, conservatives, Trump, you name it. They're all coming out of the closet now, or should we say getting out of the closet right now, being the lecherous, lying, I'll let you fill in the blank, that they are. People getting fired left and right. I think there were like seven major media figures from four or five different stations, outlets, whatever, canned this week, and several more canned for outrageous stuff that they wrote. So one guy wrote, I'm not making this up, in a national periodical, I'm sorry, I don't have the name here for you. There's just too much stuff here on the hotel room desk. And I'm without my producer, obviously. So, but one guy actually wrote that white DNA was evil and needed to be altered. I'm not making this up. That was a national publication. He did get fired. That's one good thing. And, of course, Matt Lauer at NBC, and there was another guy at PBS and another guy at CBS. I mean, it's just outrageous. So in the meantime, while they're all chortling and rubbing their hands in glee for like the, 500th time since Trump announced in June of 2015 he was running for president, for the 200th time they're pronouncing him done, gone, dead, hanged. Wow. Hope springs eternal in the alt-left breast. Better not say that around Al Franken, huh? Okay, so we have a whole bunch of stuff to cover. And I'm also going to tell you a little bit about bricks and mortar bookstores, because this is a story that you really probably don't know. You might have sensed, but you don't know. I think you'll find it fascinating about Barnes & Noble and what's happening with brick and mortar bookstores, etc., and why you really need to support them if you are a lover of books and bookstores and that whole ambiance. And if you are not so much a lover, although you may use them, of the online outlets like Amazon, etc. So So we have a lot to cover. So I'm going to get started. Number one on my little story, let me tell you a story. So this is going to be short this morning. So this one hotel that I'm staying at in Cheyenne, I signed at Warren Air Force Base the last 2 days. Great folks. I think half the base is reading the books out there. It's terrific. 90% of the staff at the BX and the commissary. So it was like old home week. And lots of new readers, too. Anyway, so the hotel I'm staying at, there's a little gal at the front desk. And, middle-aged, very nice. And we were talking, and I gave her my card and said, you ought to come down to Barnes & Noble. I don't think she could get on the base because I'm signing there today, Saturday, and tomorrow, Sunday. And then I'm headed down, and I'm going to be signing at Pueblo and Albuquerque, New Mexico. But that's yet another tale. And I invited her down to come, get a book or two or whatever, because she was very interested and had looked at the website and all that stuff. And I could tell by the way she responded, was saying, well, I really can't go down there right now. And then I asked a couple of other questions, kind of indirect. And, it occurred to me that she wasn't in the best financial condition. I'll just leave it at that, which... At one time or another, we have all, I don't think there's any exception to this, to any of the couple million folks listening around the world, I think we can all admit that at some point or other, no matter how many zeros may be behind it, we have all been in financial tough times or uncomfortable times at least. What goes up must come down and what goes down must come up. Anyway, I kind of sensed this. So yesterday, Friday, when I came back, I made sure I brought a book one, Threads West book one. And I went up to the front desk. She was working in the evening. And I signed her for her and said Merry Christmas, whatever I said in the book. And gave it to her. And she actually got tears in her eyes. I mean, I knew she had wanted to read the books, and I sense she didn't have the money to buy them right now. And giving her that book, $15.95 book, whatever, and signing it for her, I didn't realize how much it meant to her until she had tears in her eyes. So anyway, it was great, kind of made her night, kind of made my night, and may I encourage you all to do one kind act, if you can, for somebody who needs a kind act, somebody less fortunate than you, sometime between now and Christmas. In fact, you ought to make it a habit and try and do it, whenever you can. But it's well worth it for you and the person that you're helping. So that's my story for this morning. Now let's get started on the rest of this crapola, because it's like, hey, it's like having an oversized, gargantuan, gigantic, monstrous, 10-foot-tall mixer blender, and you throw everything, every thought, every concoction, every lie, every corruption, every you name it, into it, and then you just blend it up, and you have a new drink every week, right? It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. By the way, I'm also going to talk to you a little bit this morning about gun control. There's some gun control stuff happening in Congress, which, of course, nobody's talking about. And I did get a few emails from people who were quite interested. I'm posting on an ongoing basis articles on Las Vegas, when you can find them. Because, boy, it's gone dark, hasn't it? Does that not raise red flags for all you listeners? It sure raises red flags for me. How does a horrific event, hopefully a once-in-a-lifetime event, but the single most atrocious event in our history, how does it go from blanket coverage to nothing, to darkness, to void, to vacuum? You know, there are no coincidences, folks. None at all. So I'm posting these articles under terror, and you can pick them out on the website, on therightsideradio.com. And you should read them because, you know, there are little snippets coming out from investigative reporters, mostly from alternative news sources, that are coming out from time to time. But, boy, the official word is mum. And the mainstream media is, like, totally silent. So, anyway, I mentioned in my last show that five of the kind of most vocal eyewitnesses that had seen helicopters and multiple shooters and brass shell casings in locations other than the Mandalay Bay, like in the parking lot of the Tropicana, which, by the way, would tie in with my show 4 weeks ago when I told you about Saudi Arabia, the heir to the throne, Salman, being at the Tropicana. This was really a cover-up for an attempted assassination by King Faisal's son who wanted the throne, etc., etc., etc. You should listen to that show. I think you can type Saudi Arabia in the search bar and it'll come right up. But that kind of ties in with... Anyway, lots of these little bits and pieces, little dots circling around out there tie into one another. And I got several emails saying, well, you know, these five people that have died kind of mysteriously, if you will. I mean, kind of unusual for five witnesses, because they are. They're kind of like the people who spoke out during the Kennedy assassination. They saw a guy up in the grassy knoll. They saw shots from somewhere else, whatever. You know, dying, right? I mean, pretty healthy people, most of them fairly young, like 30, 40 years old. Well, there's been three more. And to punch this home to you about how strange it is that eight witnesses to multiple shooters, helicopters, etc., all the stuff that was never reported, that is contrary to the official report, you name it, how they have died. I mean, folks, it's only been like 6 weeks, right? It's not been a long time. I mean, it seems like it was 2 years ago with everything else going on, but Las Vegas was like 6 weeks ago. Anyway, two of the latest deaths, I want to tell you about this. I'm going to start off the many things we have to talk about this morning with that. Let me just read this to you. That's the best way. So, Kimberly Schumel and Danny Contreras were both witnesses who publicly claimed, I mean very publicly, that there were multiple gunmen that night. Two of the people that died since my show, there's now eight witnesses to Las Vegas, who saw multiple shooters, I mean, the same story, who have now died. Two of the three that died here in the last week or two include Dennis and Lorraine Carver. And they died within a half mile of their home when their Mercedes smashed into a metal gate and exploded into flames. This is from CNN's website, by the way, which is the only thing they've had on Las Vegas. Quote, the couple's youngest daughter, 16-year-old Madison Carver, told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that she heard the crash from her bedroom. When she ran outside and down the street to find out what had happened, she recognized her family's vehicle in flames. By the time their daughter heard the crash, which only happened a half mile from the Carver home, and ran down the road to see what had happened, the car was engulfed in flames. Much like everything else pertaining to Las Vegas shooting, the story just doesn't make sense. So, think about this. This is a Mercedes. You know, it's not too often that a Mercedes-Benz with German engineering, something goes wrong with it, and it crashes a half mile after pulling out a driveway and then bursts into flames. Particularly like on a residential street, it's not going very fast. I mean, does this strike you as odd, folks? Yes, strikes you as very odd. All right, so I want to talk about that. And then, by the way, one other thing I'm going to try and cover this morning. The next Barack Obama, and this is a scary dude. This is a full-blown Muslim dude in Michigan. Well-educated, he's kind of the new hope and change. He's been groomed by George Soros for years, and he is currently a candidate for governor of Michigan. He is backed by CARE, which is an arm of the publicity arm, if you will, of the Muslim Brotherhood, and he is a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been declared a terrorist organization in virtually every Western country, but this one, thanks to Barry standing in the way. Barry and the alt-left, who are allied with radical Islam. I'm going to bring you that, too, because this is a guy's name that you want to watch. And if you have friends in Michigan, you want to make sure he doesn't get elected governor, because it is a stepping stone to the presidency. And if you don't want to see a Sharia-promoting, Muslim Brotherhood-loving, full-blown, although charismatic, Muslim in the White House, the time to stop this guy is before he's elected governor of Michigan, which has, as you know, a very high, high Muslim population. All right. Let's talk about McCullough. I didn't even mention this in my rat-a-tat-tat of stuff I'm going to cover with you this morning. McCullough is, he was the inspector general for all the intelligence agencies. And you may have heard a little bit about this over the course of the week. It was kind of drowned out by the rest of this crap. And by the way, I think a lot of this crap is pounced on by the mainstream media, like, you know, Matt Lauer at NBC. I mean, who really cares about Matt Lauer at NBC? Who cares? But boy, if you can devote time to Matt Lauer, you don't have to talk about poor Mr. McCullough, the inspector general at the intel agencies, who originally brought Hillary's emails, missing emails, classified emails, private server, etc., panicked, I might add, to the purview, if you will, of the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA. In fact, he actually met with Clapper. And in his interviews, some have been on Fox, some have been in other papers, he said that when he relayed his concerns to Clapper, that Hillary Clinton had a private server that could be, and probably was, being accessed by enemy governments with classified information, that Clapper's response was, gee, how is that going to affect the campaign? Now, think about that for a minute, folks. Not, gee, what secrets have been leaked? Gee, what countries have gotten in there? Gee, how does that affect our national security? Gee, what did they read so that I know what knowledge they have? It was, how is it going to affect Hillary's campaign? Kind of tells you something. Anyway, he was shut down by the intelligence agencies. They poo-pooed him. He was ridiculed, not by Republicans, but by Democrats, when he testified on the Hill. And he was basically kind of ostracized from the whole intelligence community. This is the Inspector General, 26-year Democratic appointee, by the way, 26-year patriot, you know, one of those unsung people in government who really do believe in America and toil for the best. And he was also informed, his family was threatened by unknown people, but believed to be tied to Hillary's campaign. And he was also informed that when Hillary, quote, when Hillary was elected president, unquote, one of her first acts would be to fire him for bringing this up. Boy, the corruption runs deep, does it not? All right, the next thing I want to talk about. The Consumer Financial Protection Board. This is a concoction created by Barack Obama and Elizabeth Warren. It is a run-amuck agency that was purposely created outside congressional control, outside congressional appropriations. In other words, Congress is responsible for funding the government. This was outside their purview. And therefore, this agency, which, of course, Warren and Obama told us was going to protect consumers and help us out and protect us from those big, mean banks and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it didn't do any of that. In fact, folks, the folks in that agency, to give you an idea just how alt-left staffed it was and what its real mission was, there were 598 political contributions from people who work in that agency. 597 were to Democratic candidates, including Hillary Clinton. One out of 598 was to a Republican candidate. Does that kind of give you an idea about how this agency functioned? The guy that was appointed, and it was a huge brouhaha in Congress. In fact, I had it on the show. This is like 2 or 3 years ago when this rogue outfit was created by the alt-left. And if you want to, you can type in Consumer Financial Protection Board and probably you'll get that show up. The guy that was appointed to run it was, you know, an alt-left lackey of Obama's. His name was Cordray. And Cordray resigned his position. I guess, you know, there was too much heat from the Trump boys trying to drain the swamp. He resigned his position a week and a half ago. And his second-in-command, I forget the gal's name. I mean, it's really, you take one look at her in a picture on TV and you can tell she's an alt-left progressive wacky, okay? Because it was set up so that it gets its funding directly from the Federal Reserve and not from Congress, there is no oversight. And the way that it was set up, kind of on an executive level, not even through a proper law or passage of a law, the way it was set up was if the director is absent or unavailable, then the assistant director shall become the acting director. Now, you know, absent or not available is not the same as resigning your post, not in my world anyway. So this guy resigns his post. He appoints, like he's, you know, King Tut, his assistant, this whackball liberal gal. No, I'm sorry, that's an insult to liberals. This whackball alt-left progressive gal who had been the assistant director to be acting director. Trump says, no, sorry, I'm the president of the United States, and I get to appoint it. And he appoints Mulwinney is budget director, who has publicly said that this outfit ought to be disbanded, that it was a blight on the government. Anyway, a big brouhaha ensued. It went before a federal court, and the federal court, by the way, a Trump appointee, ruled in favor of the presidency, not Trump's favor, saying, you know, this is an executive department. And as an executive department, the president has full authority to appoint the director. Anyway, it's going to go through the appeals court, and we know what the outcome will be in the Supreme Court. Who knows what the D.C. stacked by Obama appeals court will be. Here's why this is important. Number one, it underlines the extent to which the deep state exists. Number two, it highlights the extent to which Obama and the alt-left have peopled or created departments and agencies within the government which are alt-left in their thinking. Entrenched deep state alt-left. And number three, it is a test of the Constitution, which is quite clear on the powers of the president as it relates to the executive branch of government, which this agency, if it had been set up properly, would absolutely fall under. So there's some big constitutional things going on, too. Now, just as importantly, this agency, this will give you an idea. The big banks, the really big mega banks, they want this agency to stay in place. Now think about this. This is an agency that was created to protect consumers from banks, but the big banks want it in place. Do you know why? Because this agency, in imposing its hard, ham-fisted rules and regulations, the big banks can just hire more staff, charge more fees, and they can kind of absorb it. Where it's really hurting banks is on Main Street, community banks, local banks, regional banks, the banks that we all work with, the banks that make America work. These mega banks don't do squat. Okay, it is the bank on the corner in your town that makes your town work. Trust me on this. And it's the bank that, there's always exceptions, but it's the bank that you can trust more than any other. Because they know you, they know the community, and they have, shall we say, on-the-ground common sense, usually. There's exceptions to all rules. So the big banks want this agency, this rogue agency, that spews out regulations like a machine gun, to stay in place because what it does is it makes the environment more or less competitive for them and more competitive for their smaller banks that compete against them. Let's face it, when a small bank does a loan, Wells Fargo doesn't do the loan. So to the big banks, it's all about the hell with America, right? The hell with you and me, the hell with Main Street. Anything that a federal agency, even though it's illegal, can do that hurts smaller banks means more business for the big banks. So this is why this is, for all those reasons, that's why this is a really important story. And I think it's going to be resolved in Trump's favor, particularly with this initial ruling by the federal court. It'll then go to the appeals court, and then it's going to go to the Supreme Court. Which, by the way, ties into my Judge Roy Moore and Judge Corrick segment coming up. Okay, let's talk about Black Lives Matter. So Black Lives Matter has this whole thing going that Christmas is too white. Too white. You know, it's racist. It's it's oppressive. You know, white snow is racist, and a white snowman is racist, and Santa has a white beard, and Santa is a white guy, an old white guy, probably an old Republican white guy. I mean, who knows? Who knows? I can't even begin to get my mind around the thoughts of these whackballs. But they've organized like a huge, they think, in their minds, this huge boycott of white-owned businesses for Christmas. Yeah, they're gonna drive Whitey out of business. Anyway, I just thought I would alert you to that. I might have put an article. I might have had the producers put an article up under Loony Left. You might check there. If not, you can Google up Black Lives Matter and White Christmas. Just type that in the search bar, and you can read their craziness. I mean, it's really quite unbelievable. One other quick little segment, by the way. This Black Lives Matter stuff that's going on, okay? This is in the... Listen to these stats. So they're bringing up all this crapola. In the meantime, black unemployment is at a 20-year low. That's right. Black unemployment is at a 20-year low. No thanks to Mr. Obama, when it reached, by the way, I think it was an 18-year high. But in 1 year of the Trump presidency, black unemployment is at a 20-year low. And the amount of black males between the ages, I believe it's 18 and 28, that had the highest unemployment, the amount of jobs has doubled. for that age group of black youth under Trump had nothing to do with Obama. It was just the opposite. So in the face of those stats, these Black Lives Matter is doing their Black Lives Matter thing. It's remarkable. And by the way, those white businesses they want to shut down, you know, I have a feeling there's probably black kids between the ages of 18 and 28 working at them, but they don't care about that. Now, the Lynch-Clinton tarmac meeting. So I reported to you, this is months ago, you can put in Lynch-Clinton tarmac, I'm sure the show will come up, that there were emails that the FBI was withholding. The FBI, in fact, under Comey, said there were no emails. There was no communication concerning this matter, blah, 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 blah. And then the Justice Department, after Sessions got in, found a bunch of emails related to the Clinton and Lynch tarmac meeting. And guess what? A whole bunch of those emails were back and forth with the FBI, the top guys at the FBI, including Mr. Comey, you know, Mr. Honest Comey. Well, there were 30 documents the FBI never did release. Judicial Watch, because they do a great job, got those. They came out, and just as I told you in that show months ago, the FBI was not concerned whatever with the fact that this illegal, stinky, smelly, improper, unethical meeting had occurred between Lynch and Bill Clinton on the tarmac in Arizona. But it was concerned with two things. These emails were concerned with two things. Number one, how to keep it secret and how to handle the press and the public. And number two, tracking down whoever had let this story out so they could be punished. Now, as we all know, it came down to a local reporter down there who was sharp enough to happen to be in the right place at the right time, recognize the plane, recognize the figures out on the tarmac, and off the story went. Otherwise, we would have never known, folks, because the FBI under James Comey was involved in its active cover-up in conspiracy with Loretta Lynch's Justice Department. That's what these 30 emails prove. And by the way, probably more felonies in there, but let's hope we get a special prosecutor to go into all this stuff. That would be nice. All right. Next little snippet. I don't think I brought this up at the front of the show either. So, Colin Kaepernick. You know, pathetic. Just pathetic. Now, I want to tell you, I'm not a big sports fan. You know, once in a while, I'll watch a quarter of the Broncos, usually the last quarter, because most Bronco games are decided like in the last 2 minutes anyway. And if they happen to be playing the Super Bowl, maybe I'll watch like the last half. I mean, I'm just not into that stuff. And as far as baseball goes, I mean, if the Yankees, I just happen to like the Yankees, or the Rockies, I guess, are playing, I might watch an inning or two if I happen to skip across it on the rare occasions I'm watching TV. And other than that, you know, I mean, I don't watch any basketball. And I will watch some Olympics. But I'm not a big sports guy. But I tell you what, I have gone out of my way not to even click through the channel of an NFL game this year. And this all started, of course, with Colin Kaepernick, who started the whole kneeling ridiculous stuff. As a sidelight, the sorry excuse for a commissioner that they have, who wants to be paid $49 million a year, and can't seem to take a stand to even enforce the league's own policies, which is you will stand with your helmet under your left arm during the national anthem. The league is contributing $89 million to causes which are the causes that the athletes who are kneeling in protest, you know, I guess Black Lives Matter. I don't know what causes they are. You know, What do you want? Dead pigs. When do you want them now? Maybe that's a cause. I don't know. I'm not being facetious here. I'm just saying it's unbelievable. So the league is trying to buy off. Instead of enforcing its policies and firing some people or suspending some people, it is trying to buy off its players from kneeling. It's too late. Viewership is way down. Seats are empty in these stadiums. Lots of people like me who, you know, they could count on for some ratings here and there, yither and yon. I'm done. And Colin Kaepernick, he was named GQ Man of the Year, GQ Magazine, which is a rag. And he was just named this week. He was given the Sports Illustrated Magazine Muhammad Ali Award. Now, poor Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, which was his original name, poor Muhammad Ali must be rolling over in his grave, because what an insult. You know, giving Colin Kaepernick the Muhammad Ali Award it is like Barack Obama getting the Nobel Peace Prize before he was president. It takes the Nobel Peace Prize in Obama's case, and Al Gore's case, and it takes the Muhammad Ali Award, which had been rather prestigious up to this time, in Colin Kaepernick's case, and it renders them worthless. Forever. Ongoing. I mean, it's just unbelievable. It also tells you just how far the alt-left has permeated all forms of media, including, unfortunately, sports. And all you have to do is turn on ESPN, who, by the way, had to lay off 186 people this week, all sorts of technicians and producers, and also because their ratings are falling and the advertisers are leaving them because of their alt-left views. You know, I don't need to listen to Bob Costa tell me about gun control during the Olympics. It ain't what I tuned in to see. I'd like to see our American skiers doing the downhill and bringing home the gold. Thanks, Bob. Keep your political crap to yourself. And I guess there's millions of other people who think just like I do. All right, so that's that segment. Now, gun control. So, there's this bill that Congress has come up with. It's actually a bipartisan co-sponsorship. And the driving force is Senator Chris Murphy, who's a Democrat from Connecticut, who, by the way, does a terrible job. Connecticut is a wreck. Murphy originally introduced a bill in late October. I told you about it then. It was going to expand background checks. It was going to give the government the ability to take away weapons from anybody that they thought, because they were tipped off by anybody who had a grudge, that somebody was unstable, they were going to take their guns. You know, in other words, if you got in a fight with your girlfriend, I guess, and she called the cops to get even with you and say, Joe is kind of crazy, and I think you should take his guns, they could take his guns. You know, no due process, no nothing. That bill wasn't going to go anywhere. So now there's another bill that he's come up with, of course, with some rhinos. And this bill cements background checks, and it's actually good in this way, in that government agencies, who obviously have been doing a terrible job, in some cases because Barack Obama instructed them to do a terrible job, like the Air Force and the Army, of getting information to NCIS, which is the National Clearing System, National Clearing Information System, for gun background checks. That's where, you know, all your stuff, when you fill out the forms to buy a gun, goes, and they run the checks on you, et cetera, and you get approved or not. It seems that some government agencies have not been reporting bad stuff from their people. In the case of the military, it's because of Barack Obama's edicts in his rampage to kind of dismantle the military, to neuter it, you might say. He told them that, you know, it would be you'd be breaching a soldier's privacy if you reported that they had a dishonorable discharge or any criminal activity while they were in the military or any domestic violence. And the guy who did the Texas church shooting, which has also dropped out of the news, if you notice, the guy who did the Texas church shooting was a whackball who had been in the brig in the Air Force for a year for domestic violence, had escaped from an insane asylum, and had been dishonorably discharged from the Air Force, and the Air Force, because of Obama's edicts, his intentional PC crap, had not reported to NCIS, and the guy was able to buy the two guns he used in that horrific church shooting with all those poor people in Texas. So in that respect, this is not a bad bill. It has some other riders to it, having to do with bump stocks and all, and I'm going to reserve my comment on that. But you probably do, listen, you want to keep your eyes on what's happening in Congress relative to guns. Because a bill like this, which is fairly innocuous, which you could actually support, because it closes loopholes, and I mean, it does the usual lousy government job of closing them, but it's better than nothing. Somehow bad stuff seems to get tacked onto these bills, particularly when you have rabid anti-gunners that permeate the congressional halls. So you want to keep your eyes on this legislation. You know, you can go to the congressional websites, you can go to the senatorial websites, you can type in gun control, you can see any bills that have been introduced pending, what their status is, whatever. It's a good thing to do once in a while. And you should certainly keep your ears tuned to whatever bulletins or memos that the various gun groups, pro-gun groups like the NRA or Citizens Right to Carry, et cetera, send out. Let's see. Let me read this to you. It's called the Fix NICS Act. So Fix NICS Act. It's far preferable to some of the other gun control measures bandied about since the October 1 shooting in Las Vegas. I guess we're 8 weeks past Las Vegas. Several days after that shooting, a bipartisan House bill was introduced that would retroactively criminalize not only bump stocks, the obscure weapon modification used by Vegas shooter Stephen Paddock, but also any device that increases a semi-automatic weapon's rate of fire. A few weeks after that, another bipartisan House bill was unveiled that would require background checks for the purpose of bump stocks. I mean, look, I'm not going to get into my personal opinions on bump stocks and that kind of stuff. I'm just telling you, watch even what seems to be innocuous gun legislation carefully and cry holy hell to your senators or congressmen if it starts looking nasty, and pay attention to memos from the pro-Second Amendment groups. Okay, let's talk tax, shall we? Wow, we're rocking right along here this morning. Woohoo! Everybody's going to be so happy. I might even be on time. Well, it's a miracle. Miracles can come true. They can happen to you when you're young at heart. See, that's why people turn up the radio when I sing. Okay, so the tax bill now, there's one pat, so you know. And I'm really glad I held off because there's been a million changes. I would have wasted your time for the last 2 months squawking about the tax bills like all the mainstream media did when they didn't know squat. Listen to some of these commentators. You got to wonder if, never mind where they went to schools, but if they went to school, like 2 plus 2 really equals 4. These bills are now at the point, and they're still going to get some massage in the conference committee between the House and the Senate. The House has passed a bill. The Senate is about to. I have not turned on the tube here since I started the show, but they were like getting ready to vote at 1:30 or 2 this morning. So as I am recording this for you, it may be passed. If it's not, skip whatever I'm saying, but it may be passed. But let me tell you about these bills. Number one, The Democrats, the progressive alt-left, are a bunch of rotten friggin' liars, which, of course, we knew all the way along. It does not raise taxes on the middle class. It is not a windfall for corporations. It is not any of the crap that they're saying. Even the Washington Post, which is an alt-left rag that is owned by an alt-left whackball, but brilliant businessman, Mr. Bezos from Amazon, even they called what the Democrats are calling this tax bill, they gave it four Pinocchios, which is their highest level of falsehood, and they called it a lie. And Chuck Schumer, still today, after all that, after being called on the carpet, all these independent think tanks studying this thing, the Congressional Budget Office, you name it, even in the face of all that, Schumer has the cojones to get up tonight and talk about how this bill is really transferring money from the lower middle classes to the upper classes. And the old class warfare, divide them, progressive alt-left crap. It's just unbelievable. So what I'm going to do for you this morning is I'm going to give you some examples. And hopefully this one article is up on the Right Side website under tax, so that you can kind of you go with the example that best suits you, and you'll get a feel for what this tax bill is doing without getting into the weeds of all this stuff. I'm just going to boil it down to dollars and cents. So let's say you are a single teacher, and you're making $50,000 a year. Under the current tax code, you pay $5,474 each year in federal income tax. Your bill will go down under the House plan by $914, which is 17%. And under the Senate's plan by $1,104 or 20%. So that's, if you're single making $50,000, okay. I'm not going to go into how all that happens. I'm just going to give you kind of the highlights because that's really what's important, the money in your pocket. Let's say you're a family. Okay. We'll call you the Joneses family. And the family is making $75,000. Okay. The wife is working, the hubby's working, you get a couple kids. Under the House plan, well, you would have been paying $1,753 each year in federal income tax. You're under the House plan, your bill would decline by $1,033 or 59% to $720. 60%, I'm rounding numbers, 60% drop in your tax bill. If you are a married couple, two or three kids, homeowners, $75,000 annual income. Under the Senate's plan, your bill would go down $2,014, which is 115%. You'd actually, instead of paying $1,753 a year in federal income taxes, you would get a refund credit, cash, of $261. $261. So let's go to the next. And by the way, if you didn't own a home, if you were renters, your tax cuts would actually be a little bit higher. Let's go to the Smith family. The Smith family, let's say husband, wife, two kids, and they make a lot of dough. They make a lot of money. They make $1.5 million a year. Under the House plan, their tax bill would go down, their tax bill would go down $87,993. Now, what's interesting is under the Senate plan, their tax bill would go up $113. To give you an idea, because remember, the top 10% pay 70% of all income tax in the United States. That family, prior to the tax bill, would be paying $439,275 in federal income taxes. So, oh, did I say that just by right? Yeah, okay. Actually, I got that just the opposite. Excuse me. Under the House bill, their tax bill would increase, not decrease, by $87,993 or 20% to $527,000. I had it just the opposite. Excuse me. And under the House plan, I'm sorry, and under the Senate plan, it's a little confusing, right? I'm glad they simplified it. And under the Senate plan, it would decrease $1,313, 0.3%, not increase, but decrease $1,313. Pretty interesting. Let's talk about the Fernandez family. They have an annual income of $250,000. Once again, guy, gal, couple kids. Under the House plan, their tax bill would go up $799. Under the Senate plan, their tax bill would go down $9,325. To put this in dollars and cents for you, they would have been paying about $37,000 in tax. So the House plan, they would go up by $800, and on the Senate plan, they would go down by about $9,000. Let's go to the next example here. Whoops. Maybe those were the four examples. Yes, they were. Look, I can go into all sorts of stuff here for you. Let me just tell you that the bottom line is, and this is by like 10 different think tanks, left, right, Congressional Budget Office, you name it, it appears that if you are low or middle income, 80% or more of you are going to realize fairly significant tax savings. And it comes from a variety of sources. Not the least of which is, up to now, you've been able to take the first $12,000 plus or minus of income. I'm not going to get in the weeds on this. Have been tax-free. You make $12,000 a year, pay no tax. That's doubling to $24,000. So it's kind of like you're getting $12,000 of income a year with no tax on it, which in the past has always been taxed. So that starts it off. And then there's lower percentages and all sorts of other stuff. Also, under the tax plan, and I've talked about this incessantly the last 4 or 5 weeks, folks, wealthy folks in a number of blue, actually it would happen in red states too, but predominantly in blue states, you know, some of the Northeast states, New York, Illinois, California, who for years have been subsidized, their state tax and their property tax outrageously high because of all the social programs and vote buying that those progressive state governments implement. The result being that the only pocket the government has is yours at the end of the day. The government doesn't have a pocket other than yours, folks. Any money it has comes from you, period. It ain't a business. It doesn't generate its own dough except when it's running the printing presses. So those folks in blue states who are wealthy, who are paying really high property taxes and really high state income taxes, and who heretofore have been able to deduct those from the federal income tax, meaning the rest of us have been subsidizing their deductions, subsidizing, in effect, their state government and its poor choices. those people are going to see higher taxes because they're going to lose a huge deduction that they've been claiming at everybody else's expense under either one of these proposals. And then the third thing which I'll bring to your attention, and I don't agree with this, and that is there from here on in, the interest on student loans will not qualify for deductions. Now, given the fact we have $1.3 or $1.4 trillion in student loans, and I've talked about this on economic segments in the past, given the fact that there's been testimony on Congress that if you had a big problem in that $1.3 trillion debt market, you could, like, really do damage to this economy. You know, it'd be kind of similar to the housing bust type of thing. But going a step further, because most of that debt is by millennials. I mean, it's owed by millennials. And that debt is what has driven 30% of millennials back to mom and dad's house because they can't make it on their own. They can't service the debt and pay their living expenses without help from mom and dad or living at mom and dad's place. And it's created a class of desperate young people. They can't get ahead. They can't plan to buy their first house, to get married, to have kids, to, you know, do whatever. All of which, by the way, also hurts the entire national economy. Millennials now outnumber baby boomers, folks. The millennials are now the largest segment of the population by age, followed by the baby boomers. Now, obviously, there's less and less baby boomers every day because baby boomers are older and they are dying off. Millennials are young, and while they have their ups and downs and attrition, they are really relatively stable and huge proportion of the population. We also know from Bernie Sanders that, what was it, 60 or 65% of them thought he was just terrific, and he's a socialist. There was a recent survey saying that like 50 or 60% of them thought socialism was good, was better than capitalism. In my opinion, this student debt, this $1.3 trillion that's hanging over these kids' lives and affecting all their decisions and all their plans, is what's turning them toward a socialist feeling, a socialist bent, if you will. It's what's turning them against capitalism. Think about this. You're a young kid. You go out, you take on, never mind whether you were smart to do it, but you do it. You take on $40,000 of student debt. So many of these kids have taken on more. And your interest is, you know, $3,000 a year, whatever it is. And then you can't get a job with a degree that you took the debt out to obtain. And then you have to go live with your parents. And then you have to struggle with your job at, you know, McDonald's or whatever you're doing to make ends meet, even living at your folks' place and to try and pay your interest on your student loan. And now your deduction for that interest is going to be taken away. I think that's the one thing in this tax bill. I mean, there's several things I would have changed, but that's the one thing in this tax bill I think Congress does not have right. I don't think it's right politically. I don't think it's right morally. I don't think it's good for the country. I don't think it's good for millennials. I think it contributes to their jaundiced view of capitalism. And in the end, you know, what's five? I'm taking a number. What's 5% of $1.3 trillion? You know, I guess it's $50 billion, huh? Is that right? $50 billion? Yeah, I guess that would be right. $1,000 billion's a trillion. Anyway, that is something. I'd rather see them cut social programs, which need to be cut. Let's face it, entitlements need to be cut. I mean, these people that are worried about increasing the deficit, how about cutting spending? Do the tax cuts. In fact, do more of the tax cuts and cut the friggin' spending up there. So, you know, the $50 billion can be made up, or whatever the number is, in the deductions and the loss of income to the Treasury by letting millennials continue to write off their interest on their student loans, by cutting some entitlement program or a combination of them, or their studies of the mating habits of snail darters, or how fast a worm crawls across a one-foot plank, whatever ridiculous things they waste money on now. And that's what should be done. Now, this is my personal opinion. But in all other respects, the tax bills, though not perfect, and I would have gone a lot further, the tax bills are shaping up to be of huge benefit to lower and middle classes, and in some case, in the Senate bill, kind of the upper middle classes also. And forget the tax savings. Okay, there's a number of studies out there by Cato and all sorts of people, and, you know, not left, not right, I mean, just economic think tanks that are projecting, in addition to the tax savings I just went over with you for average family, that your wages should increase over the next several years by an average of $4,000. If you are this typical family making $73,000 with two kids, etc., etc. So $4,000 increase in wages because businesses are doing better because of the business tax breaks, plus your $2,000 in that particular example, savings and taxes, that's $6,000 a year. You know, that's almost 10% of your annual income. That's a big difference. And of course, it also underlines just how blatantly untruthful the alt-left is. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, right? The party of division, the alt-left of division, gender, race, religion, income, age, you name it. All right. So that is your little kind of bring up to speed on the tax deal. And once again, I can go into details, but the details are still going to change because they're going to have this joint conference. But I don't think you're going to see, in terms of effect on people, too much of a change from what I just went over with you. How they get there may change. The unintended consequences, such as the millennials, I mean, Congress needs to screw on their head here. These kids, you don't want to lose them to socialism. You want them to be productive members of society. You want them to get out of mom and dad's house. And you want them to have hope and to plan for the future, which not only is great for them, but it's great for the country, it's great for the Constitution, and it's great for business. All right, enough of that. Now, I'm going to end the show with kind of a downer. I want to tell you about the potential next Barack Obama. Gag me. Another Barry. So this guy has been groomed for years by George Soros. He's going to be like their new champion of hope and change. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren's been campaigning for him already. He announced in February he's running for governor of Michigan, which, of course, from a governorship, you know, you're only kind of one step away from the presidency. The guy is smart. He's really well educated. He's very articulate. He's kind of like Obama. He speaks in these broad, emotional platitudes without telling you squat. I mean, same type of mannerism, same type of presentation, same type of devious Saul Alinsky alt-left ideology. However, he is also a Muslim who believes in Sharia, is a supporter of, if not a member of, the Muslim Brotherhood, and is being supported by CARE, the Muslim Brotherhood's PR arm, if you will. His name is Abdul El Sayed. That's S-A-Y-E-D. That's L-E-L-S-A-Y-E-D. Abdul El Sayed. He was born in the United States. He is a doctor. He lives in Detroit, Michigan. And let me give you some more stats on this guy. He's scary. Rhodes Scholarship across the Paul and Daisy Soros Fellowship for New Americans Education, the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Oriel College, Oxford, Massachusetts for his PhD, and Columbia University for his MD, so radical left schools, obviously. He is supported by, and they're running constant articles now as part of his campaign, Al Jazeera, you know. Yeah, great. Terrific. You know, you never thought Barack Obama, I mean, you never saw him coming, did you? Did you really see him coming? Well, this guy, because of Barack Obama, hopefully it's going to be much tougher for this guy to achieve the alt-left's goals, which is to get him elected. And it's not just the alt-left. It's also radical Islam wants this guy elected. So this is really the marriage, you know, the unholy alliance of the alt-left and radical Islam rolled into a bundle who might become the governor of a state and could become at least a candidate for the presidency of the United States. Scary stuff. You know, Barry, baby, while his Muslim sympathies were highly evident, his, shall we say, adherence to the faith he kept hidden. Not this guy. Not at all. He's currently, Abdul El Sayed, he's currently the health commissioner for the city of Detroit. Wow. And this rise to power by this guy is exactly what the Muslim Brotherhood envisioned in its papers, called the White Papers, that the FBI discovered in New Jersey in 2003. I've had stories on this. Just type in Muslim Brotherhood in the search bar. You can listen. I mean, it's scary stuff. Nobody's telling you about this stuff. But the FBI raided a house in New Jersey and discovered the Muslim Brotherhood's White Papers, which was their plan for civilizational jihad, for a takeover of the United States and conversion of it to a mostly Muslim country over a 30-year period. And they are a huge backer, and likewise, he is a huge backer of them, of this Mr. Al-Sayed. By the way, the other people that they back is, you know, Mr. Ellison, you know, the co-chair or the assistant chair of the Democratic National Committee. Ah, there it is, that alt-left radical Islam thing again. And also Representative Ilhan. As you know, there's a bunch of major cities around the United States right now, Minneapolis, Boston. You know, Muslims have been elected to their city councils. Those Muslims have in turn made key appointments of Muslims to police and fire departments and other governmental branches. And this is all part of the Muslim Brotherhood plan, which is in writing, folks. It's in writing. The FBI has it. It's been reported on. I have told you about it. Others have told you about it. Let me just give you the highlights. I mean, you should really look it up. Muslim Brotherhood White Papers, Muslim Brotherhood Civilizational Jihad, Muslim Brotherhood in my search bar, listen to my shows. But this, let me just give you a brief rundown of their in writing plan for civilizational jihad and conversion of the United States to a mostly Muslim Sharia, or at least Muslim-controlled, even if they are the minority. I mean, think about the Muslim countries. You know, the Sunnis are minorities, like in Saudi Arabia. They constitute like 8% of the population. They run the country. So the Muslims believe that minorities can dictate to a majority. Let me read this down for you. They have a five-phase written plan for taking over America. Basically, expanding the Muslim presence by birth rate, immigration, and refusal to assimilate. Gee, sound familiar, folks? Occupying and expanding domination of physical spaces. You folks should type in mosque into the search bar and listen to my shows that I've done on their domination and expansion of physical spaces in the United States. Next, ensuring the Muslim community knows and follows Muslim Brotherhood doctrine. Controlling the language we use in describing the enemy. Ensuring we do not study their doctrine. Use Sharia. Instead, co-opting key leadership. Forcing compliance with Sharia at local levels. Fighting all counterterrorism efforts. Subverting religious organizations. Employing lawfare, the offensive use of lawsuits and threats of lawsuits, claiming victimization, demanding accommodations, condemning slander against Islam, subverting the U.S. education system, in particular infiltrating and dominating U.S. Middle East studies programs. Folks, how many articles, how many times have I told you about what's happening in public schools with Islamic teachings? How many articles do I have to post under the women's section with actual real life experience in various school districts around the country that is just this part of the Muslim Brotherhood's white paper plan for civilizational jihad? Demanding the right to practice Sharia in segregated Muslim enclaves. Demanding recognition of Sharia in non-Muslim spheres. Confronting and denouncing Western society, laws, and traditions, and demanding that Sharia replace Western law. So, folks, is there anything there that I just read off to you that you don't know personally, or have not heard, or do not know somebody who knows personally, are occurring? How many articles do you have to read? How many news sources do you have to listen to? How many letters to editors or whatever by people who are being affected by these types of activities do you need to read? How many articles under women and family safety and terror that I post on this website, or how many shows do I have to do for you to get it? This is underway, okay? And the new poster boy for this Muslim Brotherhood civilizational jihad married in the most unsavory way to the ideological goals of the alt-left, the so-called Democratic Party, is ensconced in this rising political star in Michigan, Mr. Al-Sayed. So if you happen to know anybody in Michigan, I suggest you get in touch with them and you tell them to start watching this guy and make damn sure he does not get elected to dog catcher, never mind governor of Michigan. By the way, you can also, there's been several groups now formed as people are starting to realize this, as they see a Barack Obama on steroids beginning to materialize. One guy's name is Dr. Dick Manasseri, Manasseri. He heads a group called Secure Michigan. You can look him up on the website and see some of the stuff that they have going. I suggest you do that. And keep your eyes on this next prophet, shall we say, of the alt-left Muslim and hope and, quote-unquote, hope and change. And I'm going to finish up the show now. I'm actually in time. You can hear my computer buzzing here in the background as emails come in. And people are just crazy. They're emailing me at 2:30 in the morning. Of course, if it's from Europe, I guess it's like 9 o'clock in the morning. Let me tell you a little bit about brick-and-mortar bookstores. So as you may know, the advent of online retailing has hurt retailers all across the board. I think there's been 6,000 store closings this year. Online is up. Brick-and-mortar is down for a whole bunch of reasons. Ease, comfort, deliver your house. Being able to shop and compare, I can name you a million reasons. In some cases, price. It's had a really deleterious effect, a really adverse effect on bookstores over the last 10 years. Many, many, many independent bookstores have closed. Many have closed. Like, I don't have the exact numbers, but I would almost guarantee you, since I'm in the book business, I would almost guarantee you that 50 to 60% of all independent bookstores have closed in the last 10 years. The Borders bookstore chain, 600 stores, closed 5 or 6 years ago. The Hastings chain, by the way, both of those stores sold piles of my books. The Hastings chain, 130 stores closed just last year. And Hastings was a great store. It had books, it had games, it had music. I mean, the stores that I signed in were always terrific. I had lots of readers, thousands of books every year. And they were located in towns that were not big enough to be served by a Borders or by a Barnes & Noble big bookstore. But Hastings was located in smaller towns, you know, Logan, Utah, Ogden, Utah, Moscow, Idaho, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Gunnison, Colorado. Just outside of Grand Junction, Colorado. Those types of places. I mean, kind of middle America, Gillette, Wyoming, you know. So losing them really deprived 130 fairly decent-sized cities, you know, 20 to 50, 60,000 people, of their only bookstore. And Borders was in kind of, well, it was in big cities too, but it was also in, shall we say, small cities, you know, 100,000, 150,000. And so all those smaller cities, 300 or 400 of them, lost their primary bookstore. And Barnes & Noble is the last really big remaining brick-and-mortar store. I mean, there's Seagull, and there's BAM, and there's Entertainment, and you know, they're all decent. They're all great. And some of them are trying to fill the shoes of Hastings, but it's very difficult. But Barnes & Noble is really the last big brick-and-mortar outlet left. They have 690 stores around the United States. Barnes & Noble has been hemorrhaging money for the last number of years. I think 2 or 3 years ago, they set a record. It was like $110 million loss for the year. They have a new CEO now. He wants to go to a model where they're carrying, kind of to a Hastings model, where they're carrying books. They are kind of more cramped and crammed in, go to smaller stores, carry more games, offer food, kind of the Hastings model. And they've also talked about, and I think I've talked about this in previous shows, they've been talking about closing 190 stores. You know, their least profitable, their largest, whatever. I was recently notified by my publishers, and this is really cool. The way bookstore chains place your book is called modeling, for those of you who are not in the book business. And it's determined, you know, by the corporate offices or the regional offices. And they determine that your book will sell X amount of copies and it's good for that demographic and that market and all the stuff they do. I won't bore you with the details. And it's fairly difficult to get in brick and mortar bookstores as an author. It really is. I mean, you know, unless they know you, unless people are asking for your book, unless your publisher, you know, has some clout or your distributor has some clout. And it's particularly difficult to get in Barnes & Noble, believe it or not. The Threads West books were modeled in somewhere around 100 or 125, I forget exactly which. It's not important. What's important is the relativity of what I'm saying. 100 or 125 stores around the country, which is really quite good. I mean, I'm not John Grisham yet. I just got word that it's now been modeled in 600 stores around the country, which is really a tribute to the book sales and the way Barnes & Noble views the book and all that kind of stuff. So I'm very, very pleased about that. That's not to say that brick and mortar is stable. It's not. That's not to say that Barnes, and I hope they are, I hope they're thriving. And I hope that all the other book chains, bookstore chains that are left, Seagull and BAM and Entertainment, etc., and all the independent mom-pa stores, I hope they're all thriving. I hope there's more bookstores in the future. But boy, the odds are stacked against them. So here's what I'm going to ask you to do. Number one, any time that you can buy a book, even if it's a few bucks more, and it probably will be, anytime you can buy a book at your local bookstore, whether it's a Barnes & Noble, or it's Ma and Pa Bookstore, or it's a Seagull, or it's a Desiree Books is another one, or a BAM or an Entertainment, buy it at that store. Number two, anytime that you can buy a book at a Barnes & Noble store, buy it, because of all the outfits out there, they need the most help. They are the largest. They are kind of the most strung out. And they have the most work to do at kind of revamping their model to be able to compete effectively in this rapidly increasing online environment. I mean, Amazon just kind of kicks their butts. And the last thing I'm going to do, which will help the bookstores and brick and mortar, and also is kind of selfish, is I'm going to ask you, if you are going to be buying books as a gift, or you're going to go out and be getting books 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 as they come out, then I would ask you to try and buy them from a Barnes & Noble. Because, to be honest with you, that also helps me with the modeling and confirms Barnes & Noble's feelings about expanding the modeling, and at the same time helps Barnes & Noble and helps brick and mortar overall. So there's kind of a selfish component in this, and you know, if you don't have a Barnes & Noble near you, go in and ask your local bookstore, whoever they are, because they can order the book. I mean, any bookstore can order the books. But try and give your local bookstores business. And if worse comes to worse and you're out in the hinterlands and you're not near any bookstore and you're not going near one, then, you know, get online, go to the publisher's website, threadswestseries.com, and they're terrific, and they usually have the lowest prices of everybody, and they'll get you all set up. So, support your local bookstore, whoever that is. Even in this day and age, if it happens to be one of the few remaining chains out there. Because otherwise, folks, you're not going to have a place to go have coffee and sit in a chair and paw through a book. And that's going to be a really sad day indeed. I think we all agree. So this is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Hope I gave you some stuff. We covered a lot of stuff this morning. I mean, a slew of stuff. And hopefully it was helpful to you and was interesting to you and brought some things to light. Oh, wow. I almost forgot my Coric Roy Moore thing. Oh, my. I'm slapping myself in the head right now, and I'm just about on time anyway, so I don't want to forget this. This is important. So Judge Roy Moore, as you know, the left tried to bring him down with these salacious sex fuzz, and now the stories of many of the accusers are falling apart, like the gal who said that he signed the yearbook, but now the signature doesn't seem to be his, and they won't produce the original signature so that a forensic guy can look at it, which Roy Moore offered to do, and et cetera, et cetera. And from being down, remember, all the polls, most of the polls are left-wing and lie anyway, like the left-wing does. The polls had him, he was up about 10 or 12 points, I think, before the salacious sex fuzz. And then he was down like 15 points, I'm rounding numbers. And now suddenly he's back up 7. Huh, how do you like that? You know, the people of Alabama are kind of smart. Because what's at stake here is a lot bigger than Roy Moore. Whatever you think of Roy Moore, whatever you think of the accusers, whatever you think of any of that. The reason the left is going nuts on Roy Moore is because they want to get their alt-left candidate, Doug Jones, elected. And they don't want to get him elected just to win a seat, folks. They want to get him elected so that they can block the dismantling of the deep state. And most of all, and this is where the tie-in comes to Cork. Cork, by the way, is the federal judge who originally blocked Trump's immigration plans from San Francisco, where we just had a verdict allowing that scumbag illegal alien off the hook. He blocked Trump's immigration plans. And recently, like this week, he blocked the Justice Department and Trump's cutoff of fundings to sanctuary cities. By the way, sanctuary cities is a misnomer. I'm not going to refer them to. I'm not going to refer to them anymore. Sanctuary, that's an insult to the word sanctuary. I'm going to refer to them as outlaw cities, rogue cities, nasty cities. Starting with San Francisco and working your way down over the other 300 cities and counties who declare themselves quote-unquote sanctuary but really are outlaws. So this Judge Corrick is a federal judge appointed by Obama, and he has blocked two huge matters now for which Americans, folks, Americans, citizens, whether they are legal immigrants or whether they are natural-born citizens, are going to suffer. They're going to be the victims of crime and theft and murder because of this judge's alt-left decisions that are completely contrary to law and absolutely unconstitutional, and in the end will be batted down by the Supreme Court, which brings us to the Supreme Court because it's all tied in together. You know, there's going to be a Democrat in the White House at some point in time. Again, the Democrats are going to control, hopefully not in 2018 or 2020, the Democrats are going to control one or more of the houses of Congress at some point. Now, if you don't want to have a rerun of Barack Obama's 8 years on steroids, the only thing left when that happens to stop an out-of-control alt-left combination Congress and president, and perhaps an alt-left Islamic unholy marriage, a bunch of politicians, is the court system. And in the end, the court system all boils down to the Supreme Court. And the confirmation, folks, of Supreme Court judges is in the Senate of the United States. So is the confirmation of appeals court judges and federal bench judges, like Corrick. Or like the judge that Trump appointed who just threw the nonsense at the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau under the bus, as I was talking about earlier in the show. There's two different outcomes. One unconstitutional Corrick, one constitutional this judge who followed the Constitution and executive authority, etc., etc. The battle over Roy Moore, the distraction is a sagacious sex fuzz. The real battle, folks, is for the control of the judiciary of the United States. Now, if the Republicans can maintain a majority in the Senate, we will probably get at least one more, maybe two more, conservative justices on the Supreme Court. That means that the Supreme Court of the United States, because of the age of these justices, will be a conservative, that is, constitutional, originalist body that makes the ultimate legal decisions on all laws that are passed and cases that are brought before it, to which it grants cert for the next 3 plus or minus decades. And it doesn't matter who's in the White House or who controls Congress, because the end-all be-all will be the Supreme Court. And the left knows it. And every single seat in the Senate is important to who will control the judiciary of the United States. And if we ever get to a sorry time where the Supreme Court of the United States leans left rather than leans right, is anti-constitution or interpretive constitution rather than constitution or originalist constitution, and we have a president like Barack Obama or worse, and we have a Democratic Congress like the Congress that passed Obamacare back in 2010, then Katie barred the door. This place will be, well, it'll be unrecognizable. So that is what's really going on. If you don't want to see judges like Judge Corrick out there in San Francisco, who is making rulings that affect people's lives, like poor Kate Steinle, who was killed by this illegal alien scumbag, who was then acquitted in the same, though lower, court system back there in San Francisco. If you want to see the integrity of the United States maintained in terms of value and population and demographics and economy, and you want to see a judiciary that will that will act as the final check against an alt-left control of the other branches of the government, then Roy Moore needs to be elected. You people down in Alabama that are listening to me, think big picture. You know, if Roy Moore did the scummy things he's accused of, and I happen to doubt the veracity, I mean, women wait 40 years to get, please, come on. But let's assume they're true. Then you know what? Roy Moore can go up to the Senate, and he can make the important votes he needs to make, whether it's on Supreme Court judges or whatever, on federal judges, so we don't have more judges like Judge Corrick. And he can vote on the, you know, the infrastructure plan and the healthcare plan. He can do whatever. And the ethics committee, if they find out that he really did do this stuff, he can get his butt canned. And the Republican governor of Alabama can then appoint a new Republican senator to replace him. But that option is not open if Doug Jones is elected, folks. Then you're just stuck. And I don't care what these rhino jerk senators say about it. Then you're just stuck with an alt-left liberal Democrat, and you are jeopardizing, literally, you are jeopardizing the future of this country. You are jeopardizing control of the judiciary, the final checks and balances. So that is what it's at stake, and that is the linkage between Judge Roy Moore down in Alabama and this federal Judge Corrick idiot in San Francisco. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. You have a great and safe week. We'll see you at the book signings, or we'll talk to you next Saturday.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.